Welcome to the new Tyndale House podcast. We're working to make high-level Bible research available to you to help you understand the Bible more and explore reasons why the Bible can be trusted. Tyndale House is an international centre for Bible research and a community of Christian Bible scholars in Cambridge, England. In this first series, Dr. Andrew Ollerton will sit down with three Bible scholars to discuss the reliability, relevance, and reality of the full gospel account. In this episode, Dr. Andrew Ollerton of the Bible Society and writer of the Bible course talks to Dr. Chi Chu Lee, Vice Principal for Academic Affairs at Singapore Bible College, about why we have four different gospel perspectives and the experience of reading them.
Well, it's Andrew Ollerton here. I work with Bible Society and I'm sitting today in Tyndale House in Cambridge, a place I love to visit. It's a centre of biblical research and I'm joined today by Chi Chu Lee, Dr. Chi Chu Lee, who's one of the readers here at Tyndale House. Chi Chu, welcome.
Yes, thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Now, we're looking forward to hearing about your research, and particularly we're focusing today on the Gospel of John and the theme of persecution that emerges through it. But I'd like to get a little bit of your backstory first. Could you share, particularly going way back to when you first came to faith and the context in which that happened for you?
Well, I was born and raised in Singapore. My family, my parents were atheists. So for them, any religion of any kind is superstition. So when I got to hear the gospel when I was in secondary school, it took me quite a while to even work through whether what I heard is actually superstition or is historical truth. So eventually, when I understood what the gospel means and that Jesus is a historical person and who he claims he is.
Was that from just your own reading or how were you hearing this in Singapore?
Well, I started off opposing my friends like the way my parents would have done. I think they were superstitious.
Oh, I see. So you had friends who were Christians.
That's right.
You opposed them.
Yes.
And then began to think through whether
right.
there was... Right, okay.
Yeah, so what happened was that I found that their reaction to my sneering at them, totally unexpected. They didn't retaliate. So I began to be curious why they behaved the way they behaved. So I asked for a copy of the Bible to read it, not because I wanted to know what's the truth, but I wanted to find something to tease them about. So as I read through the gospel, my first gospel was the Gospel of Mark. I realized that I had a lot of misunderstanding of what the gospel is, or who Jesus is.
But your parents remained convinced this was superstition, something from the West that was sort of, you know, a very negative thing. So you've kind of been in a context, maybe, I don't know, would you describe it as persecution or just something a bit hostile? How would you frame your experience of your parents' reaction and how you had to grapple with faith in that context?
I knew that when I decided to receive Christ, I knew that my parents will be unhappy. They will oppose me. But they did not do anything to deprive me of any of so-called... they did not make life difficult for me.
Okay.
They were just worried and unhappy and tried all their best to stop me because they thought it was not good for me. So there was certainly opposition, but I would not call the opposition persecution.
Yeah, okay.
But it's also quite unbearable because it creates tension between family members and their relationship, which is not a very nice thing.
Well, this is really helpful to hear your backstory. I mean, we'll come to your research now, but I'm sure many of our listeners can kind of identify with that sort of mild hostility in the sense that it's not easy sometimes to be known as following Jesus in whatever culture we're from. But obviously then you've journeyed through from that initial coming to faith in Jesus through to now being involved in really detailed biblical scholarship. Could you just give us a little bit of the highlights of how have you got from there to here? You're now a reader at Tyndale House in Cambridge. What was your route through to biblical research?
Well, my faith journey began when I first read the Gospel of Mark as a non-Christian. From there onwards, I really loved to read the Bible. I used to question its historicity, whether it's reliable, and I was able to get answers. So as time go on, I would just love to read the Bible. I would love to ask questions about the Bible. So that naturally leads into this desire for biblical studies. So when I went to seminary to be trained as a full-time worker in my church, my favorite subjects were always biblical studies.
Okay.
So eventually, when I was in seminary, I was approached by the dean and the principal to consider teaching full-time there eventually. So there began my journey of furthering into biblical scholarship to train other workers for the kingdom of Christ.
Yeah. Great. Gigi, that's great. I mean, I love your story. I mean, you hear this all the time, but you're another person who's been a skeptic that's actually been persuaded by the evidence, if you like. That's one thing. And the Bible, just actually reading the text of the Bible, has been absolutely central to your journey to faith and is obviously now the absolute center of your research. So could you, so we're now in the present day, we've arrived at the present day moment, and you're now a researcher at, a reader at Tyndale House. Could you give us the headlines of what is the focus of your research at the moment?
I'm currently writing a book on how Christians in the New Testament responded to persecution.
In particular, you've got to focus around, I mean, certainly one of the pieces I've read of yours, which I really enjoyed, was around the Gospel of John. Mm. One of the things I wanted to tease out, because it may not be obvious for some of us as listeners, there are big differences between John's Gospel and the Synoptics, or Matthew, Mark, and Luke's Gospels. And in our previous episodes, we've considered some of the, if you like, the sort of underpinnings of the text, the reliability. But we're kind of diving a bit more now into the content. What do they actually communicate of the life of Jesus from four different angles and perspectives? Could you tease out what are some of the differences between John's Gospel and Matthew, Mark, and Luke? They're often thought of, they're four Gospels, but they're often thought talked to as almost two categories, aren't they? You've got the category of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, often referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. Maybe you could share a bit about why we use that term. And then you've got John's Gospel as something quite different. Give us your thoughts about, tease out some of the differences.
So most careful readers of the scriptures will notice that John's Gospel has a lot of materials that are not found in the other three Gospels, which we call the Synoptic Gospels. When we look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we realize that they have a lot in similarity. In terms of the teachings on persecution, for example, very often we find in the Synoptic Gospels that Jesus gives the direct instruction of saying, do not be afraid of the persecutors, do not fear, you know. Although we do also see that in John, right? There was once that Jesus did say that, do not fear. But we see John very different, as in John has this description of various characters in his gospel that they are afraid, and then how they would respond in terms of the persecution they're facing because of their fear.
Okay.
So this whole narrative, all these characters don't appear in the Synoptic Gospels.
Yes. Yeah. So what do you, I mean, so you're thinking of a difference of emphasis maybe, that the
right.
Synoptics sort of say, do not be afraid, and then John actually entertains that idea a little bit more differently to the other three.
Mm-hmm.
What do you put that down to? Because I suppose, before we get into the theme of persecution, just stepping back from that, I suppose some of our listeners may be thinking, well, is there a problem that John's Gospel, I mean, some people think it was written a bit later, perhaps. Would you give any, do you have a view on when we think John may have landed in terms of the first writing?
Well, it seems that John has a tendency to presume his readers do know some things about the Synoptic Gospels. So it is quite likely that he has written it later than the other three, as our historical sources among the church fathers also would tell us so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the dating comes a little bit later.
That's right.
Which obviously in itself is not problematic at all.
It's not problematic, yes.
But in terms of the way that the data, the information is arranged and the content is different, I mean, for example, classically people point to the fact that the cleansing of the temple comes very early in John's Gospel and is seen as the final week in Jesus' life in the Synoptics and things. I mean, what's your view on, do these things cause a problem, or are they in some way, can they be reconciled, and do they enhance each other? What's your overall feeling?
So whenever we recount our conversation with one person or a small group of people, we would rarely quote the exact words of that referred conversation. We always rephrase it. And then when we recount it to different people, we may also situate the incident slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
So it is so natural, because we don't replicate everything exactly. because we don't have a photographic memory, nor do we have a what I coin it as the audiophonic memory, where we just repeat everything exactly, but we always repackage it. So it's something natural that everybody does.
Yes.
So when it comes to the gospel traditions that the various authors put across, it is similar in that way. And we know that in our daily life, we accept this kind of repackaging as reasonably representative of what is happening.
Hmm.
Yes.
No, that's I agree. You're partly saying the gospels reflect human diversity, where actually everyone experiences the account differently, and everyone records that differently, captures the narrative. So it's the same, if you like, the same one coherent life of Jesus, but viewed from those different angles, and therefore you get different takes and different emphases. And I suppose in a way, I mean, that, I don't know about you, but my reflection is that helps, can actually be part of the enhancing of the reliability. If it was all framed in exactly the same way, we might think it was all a bit stitched up, you know, a bit too much kind of collaboration has gone on. So some of the differences can actually be part of the the reliability.
Right. If we talk about an illustration from life, it's like three of us are talking, and then three of us recount the incident to different people, and we find the commonalities as well as we find slight differences in the way we repackage or present. So it does give credibility as being multiple witnesses of the same event, right? So, but I would like to add that there are times when the gospel authors use the teachings of Jesus in a way that they want to apply it to their audience, as in they understand what are the needs of their audience, such that they want to make the teachings of Jesus relevant to their audience. So let me cite an example. Just now we mentioned about this teaching called Love Your Enemies. Now we find that Luke recounts it with a next phrase that says, pray for those who mistreat you.
Mm-hmm.
While Matthew renders the next phrase as, pray for those who persecute you. So we see that mistreat is somehow a broader application, and perhaps that's what Luke wanted to do, to let his audience apply it to any situation of mistreatment.
Yes.
But for Matthew, because he specifically wants to encourage his readers, or rather his audience, with regards to the pressure of persecution, then he frames it more specifically for his context, which is persecution. So it is the same teaching, applied slightly differently.
Mm.
But I'm sure when Jesus looks at both of them, he said, yes, you have represented me very clearly, and you know how to correctly apply it to your audience.
So in other words, the difference is not only do they reflect the human personalities of the gospel writers, but they're not just haphazard, they're actually intentional. Some of the differences are because the gospel writers have an audience in mind, a context, and they want to frame the teachings and the life of Jesus to really meet the needs and of that audience. So let's come on to that with John's gospel then, and this theme of persecution, which is the focus of your research. Could you share a bit then, how does John, or what do you think, in terms of audience, what do you think John has in mind when he is writing his gospel in terms of how he can help his readers in the context of persecution? Could you give any of the backstory, for example, if we assume John's gospel is written, you know, late tail end of the first century, what's the backstory? What kind of setting are believers in at that time, and how might John be framing his gospel for that audience?
The gospels are generally written for a wide audience, although it does have some consideration for the more immediate audience that the author has in mind. So it is not easy to ascertain the exact audience that John is thinking of, other than the fact that from church history, we probably know that in his later days, he was in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey, and this area where he serves. So this could be that area of people. This could be the audience that he has in mind. But however, he is recounting what happened decades ago at Palestine. So, I would think that he seriously is recounting what happened at that time when he was with Jesus. Although he would think of how he could apply all these accounts to encourage his readers. So whether among the Jews or among the pagans, the Christians would always be facing persecution from their own people, whether they are Jews or they are pagans. And when they face persecution, everybody would probably be afraid.
Mm.
And because of that, it seems clear to me that John does try to frame his whole narrative to address the issue of fear, because he mentioned about the fear of the Jewish leaders at least four times in the gospel, knowing that, and that gives us a hint that this is the very issue that he's trying to address.
Mm.
But because it is placed in the life of Jesus, he can also use these cases to encourage Christians who are in a non-Jewish setting as well.
And I suppose if we assume, and I know some do and some don't, but if we assume that the Apostle John is in some way the author or content feeder for the Gospel of John, and he's obviously exiled on the island of Patmos for a period, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
We know that someone like Polycarp, one of his disciples, is martyred early into the second century. So there's a context then that is good, I suppose, a good reason to be afraid, right? There's a lot going on that would have been life-threatening, not just mild hostility, but life-threatening possibilities for following Jesus. And so in the gospel then, you pick up on some of the ways in which this idea of fear plays out, and yet that John is calling Christians through the way that he sets quite strong categories within the gospel. He's calling Christians not to sit on the fence, if you like, or arguing that there is no fence to sit on. Could you perhaps just tease out a little bit how the gospel frames its message to make it clear that there's a decision to make and a call to follow regardless of the cost?
All right. John often liked to use opposite terms in his gospel. We see terms like love and hate, light and darkness, truth and lies, right? So he uses two phrases, not of the world and of the world, to demarcate Jesus and his disciples. So, for example, Jesus says, if you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, therefore the world hates you. So we see these opposite terms, of the world, not of the world, love and hate, right? So the love and hate in this statement actually intensifies the contrast, right? That these two groups are mutually exclusive and in opposition, which means that one cannot say that I am not of the world because I believe in Jesus.
Mm.
But at the same time, I think the world can still love me.
Mm-hmm.
For John, that's impossible.
Yeah, okay.
So, which means that he leaves no room for a person to be on the fence or to be identified with both. So, neither can one wish to be on Jesus' side and yet to have the world love them, or to even say that I'm not taking sides.
Hmm.
I don't want to be off the world or not off the world. There's no such middle place to be.
Hmm. Oof, wow, I'm starting to feel challenged now. This is because effectively what you're saying is he's turning up the contrast, right? He's saying you're either in or you're out. So you're either light or darkness. You're either of Christ, in Christ, or in the world. And I suppose, I mean, that's a real challenge, isn't it? That really hits home today because, Western Christianity, it can be very comfortable to be a Sunday Christian, I suppose, someone who's confidently known as a follower of Jesus. And certainly my own story, I've been in that place where I've been confident as a Christian in church and then done everything I could to hide my faith in school and in the context where peers wouldn't find that acceptable. What does John's gospel say to that then? I mean, how would you sum up the challenge of John's gospel in terms of us today and our listeners thinking about whether we're prepared to be known as followers of Jesus?
Well, there is an account in the Gospel of John in chapter 12 where John mentions that there are quite a number of Jewish leaders who believe in Jesus. Of course, we know that earlier on in the gospel, we see a lot of these Jewish leaders opposing Jesus. So now come to chapter 12, we realize that, hey, among some of them have come to know and believe in Jesus. But yet, John continues to comment that they would not openly acknowledge their fear, because they are afraid that they would be cast out of the synagogues. So then John commented on this negatively to say that because they loved human honor more than God's glory. So what's happening here is that being put out of the synagogue or being cast out of the synagogue is exceedingly dishonoring and shameful.
Hmm.
It's not like us where we say, oh, okay, if I don't go to church here, I'll just go to church elsewhere. No, in those days, once you're so-called cast out of the synagogue, you're cast out from your own community, you're ostracized, you're no longer accepted as the community, whichever synagogue you're going to go to. For them, because they emphasize a lot on group identity rather than the individual identity, to be ostracized and denied by the group where you used to belong to is very, very dishonoring and very shameful. And for people with high positions like Jewish leaders, it is even worse.
In our case, we may, you know, we perhaps don't understand those categories. We're quite individualistic, aren't we? But there's a whole excommunication almost at risk for John's audience in the Gospels. And therefore, he's recognizing that to follow Christ has that potential to mean you really are no longer accepted amongst your peers and in your context. You don't get invited to the parties, you don't get the job. Those kinds of possibilities and worse are arising. And so fear is obviously one of the natural, if you like, natural human responses to that kind of exclusion or risk and the potential consequences.
Yes.
And John is therefore writing his gospel to an audience that would have had a lot of potential fear, but he's calling them to see that there's still no fence to sit on. Is that right? I mean, this is where it's challenging, isn't it? Because we all feel the fear, but there's no fence.
That's correct.
And so do you have any, I mean, just as we wrap up this part one, and just for the sake of our listeners, just to encourage us, we're going to see actually in part two, am I right, that nevertheless, John then uses particular characters to say, actually, Jesus still has great compassion and the gospel has great compassion for those who are grappling with these issues. And we're not to be condemned for the challenges we face, but we're helped there. But nevertheless, as we wrap up part one, what's the kind of, what would be your advice to those of us who do feel fear at being really known clearly for following Jesus? From John's gospel, what can we draw on? What thoughts should inspire us in terms of how we respond to that fear, but nevertheless be clear about our faith in Christ?
Well, although all four gospels depict Jesus giving the instruction or an encouragement that that they are not to fear, that doesn't mean that fear in itself is being is a negative thing.
Hmm.
That doesn't mean that fear in itself is negative, but rather that fear is a natural emotional response to danger.
Hmm.
Which I think is also made by God, because then we know how to preserve ourselves from injury or harm from the danger. So I would say that all four Gospels would encourage their audience, with Jesus saying that he is the one who will pray for them, he's the one who will protect them, one who would deliver them. That's all common. But yet, what we would find in John is being so honest to depict how different characters actually react to fear and what they did in response. From there, I would leave our audience to our next session to look in detail how these various characters are being portrayed, how did they respond to fear, and then how does John look at them when they respond likewise.
Great.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to part two. We'll come on to those characters, but part one's been challenging. You know, I think I'm thinking don't be surprised that you feel fear, that's natural, as you say, but also don't think there's a fence to sit on. We need to be clear that we're following Jesus Christ. Chi-Chi, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tyndale House podcast, which was a re-release from the Trusting the Bible podcast, produced by Tyndale House Cambridge in collaboration with the Bible Society. In our next episode, Andrew Alton and Dr. Chi-Chu Lee delve further into her research into persecution and what it means to take risks in the Gospel of John.
By the time we come to chapter 19, we see Nicodemus bringing a lot of spices for Jesus' burial. And burial is a family business. People bury their own family members. And by doing so with Joseph, he's actually identifying himself with the family of Jesus. But yet again, John is deliberately ambiguous. He still doesn't want to say whether, you know, Nicodemus is a believer or not.
In future series, we will be exploring how to make sense of the Old Testament, digging into names in the Bible and the ancient world, and talking in depth to some of the people who study and work here in the Tyndale House Library. Please subscribe to the Tyndale House Cambridge podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts so that you don't miss later episodes. It really helps others to find this podcast if you pass it on to your friends and colleagues, and if you rate and review it.